And it's Guy, right?
Yes.
and the Eyed family?
Yep.
Okay. I always have a hard time when I've read names because I think I know pronunciations in my head, and they're usually wrong.
Well, it was interesting. Last night at the book launch party, a guy came up to me, and he said, my name is, it was something ID. He wanted it, you know.
Oh.
But he pronounced it ID. So huh. I've heard multiple pronunciations of that name.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Minnesota author Peter Guy's new novel is out. It is called Wintering. Kirkus Reviews said it is reminiscent of Jack London's To Build a Fire and John Krakauer's Into the Wild. That Guy's narrative takes us deep into both human and natural wilderness. And it's a wilderness we know, the wilderness of northern Minnesota. Peter Guy is back with us on KEXE and KBXE. Peter, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, so Wintering is kind of a thriller. It's a family saga that you're continuing from your last book, The Lighthouse Road, kind of. I mean, it's not really exactly a sequel, but if you've read your other work, you can see the ties. Can you tell us about this family that is tied to the last book?
Well, yeah, I think that's the real connection is the family. Well, the family and the place, of course, which, as you mentioned, is northern Minnesota. And I'm leery of the word sequel because that implies to me that, you know, unless you've read the first, you ought not read the second. I think that both of these novels, The Lighthouse Road and Wintering, you know, they stand alone and they stand just fine on their own. But if you happen to have read the first one, you'll notice some characters and you'll notice some themes and certainly you'll notice some places that are, you know, repeating in Wintering. And in that way, it might, I don't know, it might be almost like a form of nostalgia or something for a reader, but it certainly isn't required that one be read before the other. And like you mentioned, it's the family that, that ties them together. The first book, The Lighthouse Road, was the story of a young woman who comes from Norway and her son that she eventually has in Minnesota. And this novel, Wintering, is then the story of that son's son and his son. A lot of sons, I guess. So it's right now it's four generations of this family and their lives in northern Minnesota.
You know, it's funny that there's a lot of sons, but you've written this from a female point of view, and Lighthouse Road was as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like... I'm not exactly sure why I'm compelled to do that, to write from the woman's point of view. Certainly it seems as like a subconscious decision, not necessarily a conscious decision. And I think that part of it is that I like to offset the sort of masculine aspects of the storytelling with more feminine ones. And I guess that means, to my way of thinking at least, there's, in Wintering anyway, there's this adventure story, the story of a father and a son who go off into the woods for a winter. But then there's this sort of what I think of as a domestic part of the story as well, and that's the lives that they leave behind and the town that they leave behind and how those two things interact with each other. And one is, in this case, you know, a mostly masculine one, the adventure story part, and one is a mostly feminine part of that, being the part of what happens in town. And as I say that, I realize maybe it sounds, stereotypical or something like that, like only women do the domestic work in town while the men go out on adventure. I know that that's not true at all. It just happens to be true in the case of this story.
Yeah, but the women that you write about they're tough northern Minnesota women, and they're doing all kinds of things. I wouldn't think it was that way. I mean, for me as a female reading it, I like how much they do and how they're not necessarily typically female.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to, you know, one of the first things I just said was that it's like a subconscious decision, and I agree. I think that the lives of the women are, to me, I hate to choose favorite characters of my own, but this character of Berilavi who narrates Wintering is, I think she's my favorite character that I've ever written, and in fact, she's the one I identify most with. I mean, people often ask whether or not characters are based on people you know, or whether you base any of the characters on yourself as an author, and the answer for me has always been no, but I recognize a lot of myself in Barrett, like a frightening amount in her. And you know, I mean, I guess in that way, what you say about her doing things and her not, you know, not maybe not being stereotypically feminine, maybe that's part of the reason why.
You know, I think that's what kind of draws me to your books. This one, what year is, as they're telling the story, is it set in the 60s?
Yeah, so the story of what happens in the wilderness is 1963, and then the contemporary or more contemporary version anyway is 1996. That almost makes it historical fiction now, if you can kind of that, but, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's 33 years later, but in a time of, you know, what we would mostly recognize it now as the sort of era that we're living in.
You know, I find it so interesting the way that you're telling these family stories, and they're not, it's almost like it's the threads of the family, and I feel like a lot of people, we may not know everything about the generations of our family that came before us, but there are certain things that every once in a while in life you get this feeling, this might just be me, I might be going on, but you get this feeling like, oh, this makes sense why I'm doing this, because I remember hearing this story about this person, and it's a vague tie, but it makes you kind of rooted in where you are.
I agree, and you know, I'm not like a genealogist. I'm not the sort of person who's been on Ancestry.com and done my whole family history and know the exact places where everyone came from in my genealogy and when they got here to the United States and all that. But I do feel, and I don't really know how to describe it except as a sort of longing. Like I really wish that I knew my ancestors better. And in some sort of, you know, mysterious and beguiling sort of way, I know that I'm connected to them, and I know that I'm connected to their struggles and their struggles, even though they're so far removed from my own life, have certainly filtered down through the generations. You know, I mean, my you know, grandparents or great grandparents or great great grandparents who came here from this country, or you know, from Europe to this country, the things that they went through are things that affected the generations that came after them, and so have affected me. And I think it's very indirect, and it's hard for me at least to say, you know, this is what has influenced me or this is what has influenced me, but I just have this feeling like I know that their struggles are a part of my own.
We're talking with Peter Guy today. His new novel is out. It's called Wintering. It's kind of crazy how much I think the same thing. I have things from family members that they way before I was born. I have a great great aunt. I have her postcard collection. She never had children. I feel like I somehow know her. I ended up living in a place that's near where she lived. And it's very strange, but I kind of like to have I'm like you in that I don't really care about the specifics exactly. There's more to it that you can't quite explain.
Yeah, that's interesting that you have it too. And I've talked to other people that have it as well. I mean, there are these people, right? And I know some of them who have done the whole family tree thing and, you know, articulated their past in a way that, you know, I'm sure it's very interesting, but it doesn't, not only have I not done it, but it doesn't really hold much allure for me. I guess I also like the idea that I can imagine their lives any way that I want to, in the same way that I like to invent my characters and invent the stories that I tell. I guess maybe I'm doing the same thing with my own family. This is only occurring to me as I say it. This is not something I've thought of before, so maybe I don't know exactly what I'm talking about, but I have that feeling. Like it's all part of the same vague sense of a past that I don't exactly know, but that I know has affected me and influenced me and the rest of my family in ways that are sort of cosmic or something.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Barrett. You said she is the character you've written that you identify with the most. Just to tell us more about her.
Well, so she's a woman who, during the Depression, moves from Duluth to work for a character named Rebecca Grimm. Rebecca was one of the main characters in The Lighthouse Road. And by the time Barrett comes to work for her, Rebecca is the sort of the Mad Hatter in town. She runs the post office out of the old apothecary building, but she also sells hats. And she's an eccentric woman, Rebecca is, to be sure. And Barrett comes as a young, impressionable woman without much to her name. And she ends up living and spending the rest of her life in the town of Gumblint. She comes from Duluth. Gumblint is a fictional town that's loosely based on, you know, I mean, it's based on all sorts of things, but think of Graham Murray, I guess, as the sort of primary model for it. And she spends her whole life in this town, and much of that life she spends longing for and in love with a man who is another woman's husband. And only when that marriage falls apart does he come to her. And so she's this woman who's, you know, spent a lot of time by herself, imagining a life that she might have, and then is sort of suddenly given the blessing of this life. And she makes the most of it. She loves this man. The man is Harry-eyed, one of the main characters in the book. And so she's reflecting on Harry's life. Harry has now passed away, and she's talking with Harry's son, Gus, and together they're sort of recreating not only what happened in the winter of 1963, but the rest of her life and more of the Ide family life in this town in the years between then and even in some of the years before that. And when I say I identify with her, and when I think of her, I think I'm very wistful about it. She's a patient woman. She's a woman who has, in a lot of ways, suffered for the happiness in her life, you know, a happiness that was late in coming. But she's also very reflective. She's kind. She's gentle. And I'm not necessarily those things, but I aspire to be those things. And the thing that really connected with her is that she's sort of obsessed with the idea of stories and how we tell them and what they mean to us. And that became one of the central questions for me, the central preoccupations of this book was stories. And why is it important that we tell stories? Not just stories like the one I'm writing in the book, but the stories that we really tell each other as families, as friends, as husbands and wives and lovers and how those stories add up to make a life. And her, I guess it's a sort of discovery at the end of the novel, which I won't give away. It's not a great dramatic moment as much as it is a subtle sort of almost philosophical one. But I love where she arrives and feel like that's the place that I've arrived at in my own life.
You know, you're talking about story here, and I've had some people ask me about your book because they knew I was going to be able to talk to you, and they asked me what the book is like, and someone asked me what your writing style is like, and I was like, well, it's sparse. I don't know how to explain what I mean by that, but it's, and then I read something where it said your editor had said this thing about the words that you use and the lines, that they're really good lines, mm-hmm. and it seems to me like every word matters to this story, and some books, there's areas where, oh, I might kind of skip by this. I'm not really interested in this description of this so much. And it's not that you're not describing, but it seems to me words on their own really matter to you as a writer.
Well, they do. And in fact, it's so funny that you bring that up because I was just thinking, I just came across a word that I never saw or read before called hoist. The word was hoistway, which is apparently something to do with an elevator. I haven't exactly looked it up. But my instinct upon seeing that word that I don't remember ever coming across that word. And I was thinking, oh, like you could write a whole story around the word hoistway. And my mind thinks like that. I don't know that I'm ever going to write a story about a hoistway or an elevator or something that happens in an elevator. But I do latch on to those individual words. And it's pretty simple to me. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if you boil it down and think about writing in just its simplest, you know, as its essence is just one word after another. And so you ought to be conscious of each of those words and conscientious about each of those words and not waste the reader's time by putting in a bunch of words that don't necessarily need to be there. It's tempting because I do love the process of writing, and I do love especially the process of writing descriptive scenes that, you know, that you there's a sort of an impulse to go on and on. And luckily, I've learned a little bit how to check myself on that. But I've also had the benefit of a couple of great editors. And working with Gary Fiskejohn, who's my editor now, it was a whole new lesson in economy and how to say as simply as you can what needs to be said. And just because it's being said simply doesn't mean that it's not being said elegantly or beautifully. Hopefully it can be all of those things or many different things, you know, from page to page. But I don't know if I'd say obsessed, that was the word that came to my mind, but I'm definitely conscientious about the work, the individual work, and of course conscientious about, you know, the way that they accumulate and the way that they pile up and what they say in the end.
I do want to get to talking about the landscape of this, because the people listening to us we live here in northern Minnesota, and there's always a tie. You like reading a book about where you are, but I think you really capture what the landscape is. And I was kind of struck by, you were talking about how Barrett was from Duluth, but then she's in this Gunflint that's a little more like Grand Marais. And sometimes people think, oh, everything north is the same. And there seems to be such a drastic difference between our idea of North Shore versus like the Boundary Waters area. Mm-hmm. And that kind of plays out in your writing, too, in both of your books. Can you talk about that? How do you see those things as different?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I'm one of those people that, at least in my work, has made of the North Shore a sort of fairy tale place. So though I'm intimate with so much of it, I spend a lot of time up there. I was on the North Shore 10 times last year. And I know a lot of the spots, you know, I have a lot of favorite spots, both in the woods and in the restaurants and, you know, on the ski slopes and all of those things. But I think of it as the North Shore, like that is the place, the North Shore. The North Shore is, I don't know how to say this, more the North Shore than it is, you know, Lutzen and Tofte and Hovland and all, you know, you take any of the towns along there. And I've sort of adopted that thinking about it in my work. But there is for me also a very, and I mean, it's once you turn off of the shore and into the woods above, the hills above the shore, you're going into a different, it seems like to me like you're going into a different landscape. It's, you know, it's woods, not water, although there's water everywhere, but it's not the Lake Superior water. There's a different sort of climate. You know, the number of times that I've been up on the end of the Gunflint Trail in April or May, and there's still 3 feet of snow on the ground when it's 65 degrees and beautiful on the shore, it's different. And there's, you know, especially in the Boundary Waters, there's nothing there. You know, so it is just a complete wilderness. There's nothing, nothing civilized about it. And that distinction is very important for me, and is very important for this book as well. I mean, the fact that they're going into the wilderness is not a small part of the story. They're leaving behind, like I said, this sort of domestic and civilized place, which is the town of Gunflint, to, you know, settle some scores and take care of themselves and make some discoveries in a wilderness. And that's not accidental at all. I mean, so in that respect, they're different places, but the North Shore itself feels very much like the North Shore instead of the individual towns that make it up. Maybe mm-hmm. that sounds crazy. I'm having a hard time.
No, not at all.
Making sense of this even to myself.
That's Peter Guy. His new novel is called Wintering. He is on a book tour now. He's actually going to be in northern Minnesota at a lot of different libraries. There is a list and schedule of those at his website, peterguy.com. We're glad that you're coming. I hope that I can get out and see you at one of the libraries in northern Minnesota.
It'll be great to see you, and great to see as many folks as I can. I feel like I owe a huge debt to the people of northern Minnesota, and I would like to repay it in any way that I can. So.
Well, sounds great. So, Peter, you'll have to listen to KAXE when you're in our area, 91.7.
I'll do that.
You'll love it. And you mentioned WTIP in the book, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like our sister station, I guess you'd say. So.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and good luck.
How are you?
Have fun.
It was great.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. It was great talking to you.
All right. Bye-bye.